Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Of all that's going on and not knowing if my home is going to be there, if my dad is okay. I don't know what to say.
I can't believe this is happening, and I have no apartment. My apartment was decimated. I have no studio. So now I gotta find a place to go.
It lifted the lid on the side of the boat and then breached a hole through the wall, and then it took on water, sank.
Phones out, electric's out, everything.
Well, our house held up better than most of them, but pretty well wiped out.
We've blessed all the way, but just not knowing what we're gonna walk into when this is all over with is very overwhelming.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us on this Monday, where people in Houston and the surrounding area in Texas woke up to a third day of devastation today. That is if they slept at all. The voices you just heard there are some of the thousands facing catastrophic flooding and heavy rains and power outages from the wrath of Hurricane Harvey. The storm made landfall in Texas as a Category 4 storm on Friday night. Harvey stalled over the city of Houston, which is the fourth largest city in the country, with one of the fastest growing metropolitan areas. More than 2 feet of rain inundated Houston and continued to fall on Sunday and into early Monday. Rachel Osier Lindley is the statewide editor for the Texas Station Collaborative on Public Radio, and she joins me now from Houston. Rachel, thanks for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
We've all seen the pictures of devastation, downtown Houston submerged, streets underwater, entire sections of the city's inundated. You and your colleagues have been around the city. You've talked to people there. So what have you seen?
Well, I think the thing that strikes me the most about it, just having talked to everyone, is how quickly the flooding happened. People were walking around on Saturday around Buffalo Bayou, which is one of the main arteries of water that goes through the city. And people said, you know, oh, it's a little bit high. I guess the hurricane, dodged us. We're okay now. But then less than 24 hours later, that water that was maybe just flooded maybe 10 feet over the banks of this bayou was up and covering the streets of the bridge that went over it. So it happened very quickly, and a lot of people were caught off guard because Saturday, I mean, it did seem like a normal day. So even though people were being warned, this rain is coming, there's potential for flooding, it just seemed like it had passed Houston.
Let's hear from one of those very people who seemed to be shocked by the speed of the flooding. This is Daniel Foss. He's 31 years old, and you caught up with him in Montrose.
Okay, flash flooding here is totally different than what I grew up with. So it's crazy to see, and I can't imagine being out on the roads or being the first responders who having to go out and answer all these emergency calls and things like that.
Rachel, there's one resident who was shocked by the speed of the flooding, as you said. He also talked about emergency responders. How has emergency response been functioning so far in Houston with rescuers in boats, on dispatch, and everything else?
I think what you can say is it's functioning as good as it can be, given the circumstances. Houston, of course, has never seen anything like this. This is an unprecedented level of flooding in the city. And more than 2,000 people so far have been evacuated on boats and picked up over the last few days. The city's asked people that have their own boats, if they wanted to come out and help people as well. I had a colleague who spoke with a woman in Meyerland, which is a neighborhood of southwest Houston that has flooded extensively now. And over 2 years, in 2016 and 2015, it also flooded. So she decided to evacuate, but her son, who's in his early 20s, stayed behind. And he went around on a canoe yesterday and was rescuing people with a friend. They rescued a family and their pets as well. So people really are pitching in, and everyone's just doing what they can. But as you can imagine, the city is completely overwhelmed. 911 has been flooded with calls. vehicles. They were at capacity yesterday. The mayor, Sylvester Turner of Houston, the mayor, he asked that emergency responders give preference, of course, to people that were in life-threatening emergencies. So I heard someone on the TV news say, hey, if you just have a few inches of rain in your house, that might be a minor inconvenience, but it's not life-threatening. Like, let's not clog up the 911 lines for the people that really need it. So just the fact that that is what is being said can give you an idea of the scope of this flooding.
Rachel Osier-Lindley, we appreciate you doing that with us. She's statewide editor for the Texas Station Collaborative. Rachel, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thigh-deep water current was strong, and they helped us up to the military truck that evacuated us over here to the library. So we're just happy to be okay.
By Sunday in Houston, dozens of people had been rescued by the Coast Guard, and the National Guard were out in force to try and help people stranded in their cars along highways. Art Acevedo is the chief of police in Houston, Texas.
We've got a lot of houses and businesses that have been impacted by flooding. We have several thousand of our Houstonians that have been evacuated and are in shelters, and you know we are hurting a little bit, but we're not broken, and we'll overcome this. That's what I think we are all about as Texans and as Americans.
Do you have officers in boats going house to house in some of these neighborhoods? What does rescue look like right now?
Well, we still have officers that have been in high water rescue vehicles since the operational period started. We've conducted over 2,000 rescue missions. That's just us here in the Houston Police Department. I'm happy to report that as heartbreaking as it's been to have to take so long to get these folks, that we're down to about 230 requests for rescues, and we're very hopeful that sometime today we'll get all of those done and get these people the help they so richly deserve and need. You know, it's been a tough few days, but we're getting through it, and you know, we're not out of the woods yet. We're worried about water still coming down from other parts of Texas, and that ends up on the Gulf, and we just pray that that doesn't flood us further.
And in terms of resources, Chief, rescue and otherwise, what does your department, your city, need right now?
We're going to need folks to start sending through the Red Cross donations of clothing, you know, diapers, things that are that these families are going to need. A lot of them have probably lost almost everything. I would also really help. It would be helpful for us to have folks look at the Red Cross website that they're looking for cash donations. And at the end of the day, what we really need is long-term commitment from our federal partners and the federal government to help the city of Houston and the people we serve restore and fix everything that's been damaged by the storm.
Chief, your officers and the people who work for you live in Houston as well. What about their homes and their families? Have the people in your police department suffered losses with everybody else? I imagine they're working through this at a time when their homes are damaged.
I'm glad you said that, Todd, because what's going on with our folks is that we know of at least 30 of our own families that have been impacted by this event. They have significant damages to their own homes from either flooding or from a tornado activity that's been going on. I've got one of my assistant chiefs that water as of right now is about 2 inches from entering his home. And what makes, I think, the American police officer, as imperfect as our profession may be, and their family's heroes, is that these men and women have not left here. We've had to have them all stay here the entire time because we couldn't get them back and forth. And they knew Friday, as this storm approached, they knew that their families and their families knew that they couldn't count on their loved ones. And then, so it's just not a commitment from the police officers. It's a commitment from their extended family. And I have to say that I'm extremely proud. So far, about 30 that we know of. But we know that when we get through, that we're going to have more families have been impacted here with the Houston Police Department, and also our own facilities. We've had a damage to several of our police stations. We've lost probably about 30 police cars that have been swept away in this event. So we haven't been unscathed, but again, like this community, we'll come out stronger as a result of going through this challenge.
We've talked a lot about the rescue and the recovery that you and your officers are participating in. What about the time right after recovery? Too often in situations like this, people will take advantage of the chaos. There can be looting and major security concerns. And I wonder if you've seen any of that around Houston and what your plans are like to prevent that kind of thing.
I loathe people that take advantage of our fellow human beings when they're at the lowest point of their lives, that come through cities from around regions and other states to try to take advantage of it. My word to them is stay away from Houston. We're not going to rest. We're not going to lower our posture. We've got resources coming from other police departments throughout the state. We're going to have a huge presence here. And I promise you, if you come to Houston, Texas, to try to any shenanigans, you're going to end up in jail. And we have a nice jail cell waiting for you. We've only had about a half dozen tried to loot, and they have found themselves in jail already. So we're ready for them. So stay away, because you're not welcome. And if you show up and try those things, you will end up in jail. The same thing goes through all the fraud that goes on when people come out here and try to commit the fraud, acting like they're going to help folks when, in fact, they're just here to rip them off.
At the same time, Chief, you're going to get a visitor from the outside of a very different kind. President Trump is set to visit Houston on Tuesday. I know when any president visits a disaster zone, they come not only with sympathy and publicity, but with giant pieces of security and a lot of disruption. Is a presidential visit now a help? Is it a hindrance? Or is it neither and just part of operating in a big storm where the country's watching?
You know, presidential visits, I understand them. Every president wants to, you know, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, right? They're going to get criticized no matter what they do and no matter who the president is. It is, however, the timing is important. If it's too soon, and it can be a burden on the department. And so I trust our federal partners in the White House and the Secret Service. I'm sure that as we speak, they're assessing what's going on, the challenges in the city of Houston. And I wouldn't be surprised if when it's said and done, they either come or don't come. But I'm sure they're being very thoughtful and paying attention to whether or not there'll be help or hindrance. And we'll see what happens.
What's your assessment right now, Chief? If the president shows up on Tuesday, you're the chief. Is that a hindrance for you right now?
The problem is we don't know exactly what's going to happen on Tuesday. We have massive flooding going on because of the flow towards the Gulf. It would be very challenging for us to try to help with his visit. And so it's too soon to know. And I think that assessment, they don't have to make that final decision yet. But we'll see what happens in the next 24 hours.
Chief Art Acevedo is chief of police in Houston, Texas. Chief, the whole country's pulling for you. We really appreciate the time you've spent with us, because we know how busy you are and what a burden this is, not only on you, but on all your officers and all the city of Houston. So, Chief, thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
As the chief said, if you're looking for ways to help those impacted by Hurricane Harvey in Houston and the surrounding area, you can visit the Red Cross at their website, redcross.org. At the end of last month, former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio was convicted by a federal judge of criminal contempt. Now, Arpaio is well known for targeting undocumented immigrants in sweeps and for harsh treatment of detainees. He's faced lawsuits for violating detainee rights and civil rights actions from the government for racial profiling. But the former sheriff does have lots of fans, including one in the White House. Donald Trump had been hinting at clemency for Joe Arpaio for over a week, building up anticipation among Arpaio's supporters. And then on Friday, the White House officially announced a presidential pardon. It was a big reward for a big ally. Sheriff Joe, as he's known to his fans, was also a champion of a story that Donald Trump pushed for years before running for president, that Barack Obama was not born in the United States and therefore wasn't a legitimate president. As for the pardon, the criticism came swiftly from across the political spectrum. Liberals were incensed, and that's probably predictable, but conservatives were too. Arizona Senator John McCain said the pardon undermines the president's claim for respect of rule of law. And a spokesman for the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, said the Speaker does not agree with the president's decision. The Takeaway spoke with Cecilia Wang. She's deputy director of the ACLU, which has sued Joe Arpaio for civil rights violations.
The president's pardon of Joe Arpaio spoke directly in support of white supremacists who supported both Arpaio's policies, which courts struck down as unconstitutional, and Trump's campaign positions, which he's now implementing as federal policy around the country.
Now, those campaign positions are having a big impact, including in politically vital Arizona. Probably no community has been affected more deeply by policing in Maricopa County than Latinos. January Contreras served as an assistant attorney general in Arizona. She's currently running for attorney general in that state, and she joins me now from Phoenix. January Contreras, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's a long list of defiant actions from Joe Arpaio that have gotten the attention of Arizonans and the nation, of course. Many of them courts have questioned. In terms of policing, which stand out to you?
Well, I like the fact that you used the word defiant, because at the real core of what Joe Arpaio has done is defy the Constitution. And I think that's what is very outlandish for us here in Arizona, that he got away with it so long, despite the fact that, you know, he was running very systematic operations that just fly in the face of what our Constitution stands for.
There were accusations and indeed conclusions of racial profiling from the Justice Department targeting Latinos, many of whom were citizens. We've also heard about the tent city, the famous tent city in Maricopa County, where detainees were kept outside, often in temperatures well over 100 degrees. You say he got away with it for a long time, and that suggests that many Arizonans really supported what Joe Arpaio was doing.
Well, I think the voters showed that they were willing to keep Joe Arpaio in office, and they listened to this mantra of the toughest sheriff in America and weren't paying so much attention to the fact that this guy had forgotten to do his job along the way. And left in the wake of his tenure were hundreds of cases in one of the towns that the sheriff's office was contracted to do police work for. And they left all of these cases uninvestigated, with many victims of crime, many of those being sex crimes, without any justice. I think as those follies, those failures started to come to light, and how much money Joe Arpaio was costing taxpayers because of his failures to do his job, that's when the voters started to think, gee, you know, enough of the circus, enough of the harm. We really need to move forward with someone that we can trust to do the job.
And you think that's why he was voted out last year by the people in the county?
I do think so.
So this is part of your platform then, January Contreras, as you run for attorney general in Arizona. It's accountability for Joe Arpaio?
It's accountability for all people. And yes, that includes Joe Arpaio. When our system refuses to hold the powerful accountable the way they do everybody else, that's a real failure. And it's a very dangerous precedent. So as a former county and state prosecutor, I've never seen that at play in the way that we're seeing it at play now. The integrity of the justice system relies on everyone being held accountable to the same rules.
Well, let's listen to Joe Arpaio himself here. He spoke yesterday with reporter Jimmy Jenkins from KJZZ in Phoenix, talking about his conviction and talking about his pardon. Listen.
This is made up by the activists. It's made up by politicians that I've been guilty of racial profiling. It's not true. And I'm becoming a little disturbed across our nation how people are saying I was indicted or charged with racial profile. I was charged on a misdemeanor, allegedly, for not obeying a ruling from a judge.
Joe Arpaio is correct there. He was convicted by a judge of contempt of court, not for the racial profiling itself. But your reaction to that statement?
That sounds like revisionist history to me. It's correct that he was ultimately convicted of criminal contempt. He was convicted of that because he refused to follow a judge's order to stop racially profiling our citizens here in Arizona. You can't divorce those two things. Yes, the conviction was for criminal contempt, but that very conviction was focused on the fact that Joe Arpaio was told by a judge to stop directing the sheriff's office to conduct racial profiling, and he refused to stop doing that. And that's a violation of our Constitution. It's the violation of the rights of our residents here in Arizona. And quite frankly, it's a scary thing to wonder, well, who are they going to start targeting next?
a federal pardon from the President of the United States for former Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. January Contreras is running in Arizona for Attorney General, partly on a platform of state accountability for Joe Arpaio. January Contreras, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. We're happy to have you with us today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and today in Atlanta, the city's homeless people are about to start a big transition, and no one seems quite sure how it will turn out. The city is closing its last remaining so-called shelter of last resort. It's called the Peachtree and Pine Shelter. Shelters of last resort take anyone, with almost no exceptions. Peachtree and Pine houses about 200 men, women, and children out of a homeless population in Atlanta of about 3,500. The city, meanwhile, has a $50 million plan to move homeless families into permanent housing. But even as that transition starts today, the city has not secured any of that new housing. Chuck Steffen serves on the board of directors of the Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless, and he's with us now. Chuck, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here.
Chuck, why does Atlanta think that now's the time to close this big downtown shelter and try something else?
Well, there's a long history behind that. This shelter is located on Peachtree Street, which is the historic corridor of wealth and power and privilege in Atlanta. So the decision made by the Task Force for the Homeless to open a 100,000-square-foot shelter right in the middle of this oasis of power and wealth in 1997 was very difficult for the governing regime here in the city to accept. So I think that this decision has been in the works for a very long time. It took 20 years for those powers to run us off the corner of Peachtree Street and Pine Street.
So this is supposed to be a gradual plan, moving these families out of Peachtree and Pine to other housing. Can you describe the pace of the plan that you and residents expect, how it works, and where people are going to be going over the next couple of weeks?
So there will be an estimated 300 to 400 people who will be transitioned out of that building over the foreseeable future. And the difficulty, as we see it, is there don't seem to be the resources, or there don't seem to be the physical facilities to absorb this population. So our organization is going to be keeping very close tabs on the progress made or not made in transitioning these individuals to suitable housing elsewhere.
And here we are, Chuck Steffen, talking about one shelter downtown, a big facility to be sure, but a couple of hundred families. I mentioned that at any time there are about 3,500 homeless people in Atlanta. Does the city have a strategy to get to the root causes of homelessness in that city? Is it viable?
Let me start by saying this. We at the task force see homelessness as first and foremost a housing problem. If you sort of reframe that question and ask, okay, well, what is the city's housing policy? I think the city of Atlanta, like cities across the country, does have a housing policy, and it's called gentrification and displacement. And one can understand why. I mean, the elected officials, particularly in a place like Atlanta, surrounded by this belt of white flight suburbs, is very concerned about its tax base. And the only way you beef up the tax base is to increase property values. And the best way to do that is to run poor people off of Peachtree Street and replace them with wealthier people. So I think that in the city of Atlanta, you'll get an awful lot of happy talk about this initiative or that initiative. But in terms of addressing the fundamental root cause of homelessness, which is the absence, the lack of affordable housing, I'm not sure that the city is doing much of anything.
Chuck Steffen, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Chuck Steffen is on the board of directors of the Metro Atlanta Task Force for the Homeless. As part of our Uncomfortable Truth series on race in America, we've been hearing from many of you with your personal stories. Some of those conversations have been about adoption, usually where children of color are adopted by white families. But Lakshmi Iyer and Brandy Stein had a different story to tell.
My name is Brandy Stein. I am 29 years old. I am white.
My name is Lakshmi Iyer. I'm 41 years old. I grew up in a place called Coimbatore in southern India. I grew up in a very monolithic kind of place, in the sense like everybody looked like each other. We have diversity, but not the kind I've seen here in America.
Growing up in El Paso, Texas, I grew up in predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods, so race wasn't a thing I considered really.
7 years ago, Lakshmi, who had struggled to have children of her own, adopted Brandy's 10-month-old twin girls, who are white. Brandy lives in New Mexico. Lakshmi and her husband live across the country in Pennsylvania, along with the twins, Anjali and Mena, who are 8, and Sahana, their biological daughter, who's 3. The families have an open adoption, and they talk regularly, but they haven't really talked about race very much in this unique relationship until now.
Race wasn't a thing I understood until I started learning about the Civil War in school and realized that race was an issue for some people. And it's only impacted my life in the way that I started to actually hate being white because everybody judged me for being white. But I never really thought that I was any more different than anybody else around me because we were all poor and we were all living in the same neighborhood.
It's interesting to me that somebody being white can actually consider that a burden. It never occurred to me that way.
Well, actually, I have been wondering, like, I know you just said that there wasn't that much diversity, but when there was diversity, especially in race in India, how did people react to that?
Actually, it's a very interesting thing. It's an interesting thing that you bring up. Where I grew up, almost everybody is brown, varying shades of brown or black. But there is something called casteism. So there is a social hierarchy in the sense that if you were born of a particular caste, you got treated one way. And if you were not part of a particular caste, then you were treated differently. And growing up, I've heard about it. I've probably seen it in my family, but I chose to ignore it. It really became a big thing when I was a teenager. And as part of the caste system, I am a Brahmin and supposedly at the top of the social pecking order. So it did have an impact. Like, it's not particularly race, but that division in society where, you know, a circumstance and birth puts a person in a particular place and the impact it has on generations is something that has been on my mind for a long time. And while I've not really thought about it much before, our current political situation and the fact that I'm a mother in a transracial adoption really brings it out for me now. And it's a hard button thing for me right now. But having said that, race is something that I really never thought much about until we adopted the children. Then it was in my face all the time.
Now that I can understand, especially with the current political situation. And I think you've been doing a great job with handling how the girls are looking at race right now, especially with other people thinking you're the nanny, which to me is interesting because you were raised at a higher class system while I was raised poor. And if we were raised in the same neighborhood, we would be part of two different caste systems. So me giving Anjali and Meghna to you, I've given them a better life either way you look at it. But how does it make you feel when people call you the nanny?
Actually, first, I get defensive. I feel like I have to justify that I'm their mother and they had no business saying that to me. But then I realize some people have no filters. And if this experience hadn't happened to me, if I were an outsider looking in and I saw a brown couple with white children, maybe I wouldn't go ask them something, but it would certainly cross my mind that there's something unusual about it. Mostly, I just ignore and move on. I don't qualify, I don't justify, I don't give them an answer. But sometimes if I feel it was, you know, the intentions aren't wrong, it's just that they don't know how to phrase the question, then I try to educate. But for most parts, I'm just quiet. I just, you know, nod and move on.
Lakshmi and her husband were desperate to have a family, and Brandy was at a crossroads in her own life when she decided to put her 10-month-old twins up for adoption. Brandy was a single mom struggling to raise her girls with the help of her brothers and parents. She'd grown up poor and had one priority when it came to adoption, giving her girls to parents who would dote on them as their own regardless of skin color.
When it actually came to giving up the girls for adoption, I did go through a lot of interviews when it came to giving them up. And yeah, they were white parents, but they'd be more interested in focusing on me and impressing me versus actually looking at the girls for more than a few seconds at a time. When it came to choosing Lakshmi, it was actually the adoption agency who chose Lakshmi and Narayan as a couple, and I met them through Skype. And I never really thought about their race because the moment they saw the girls, they were focused and intent and loving the girls from the moment they saw them.
Actually, when you say that, I can almost picture that moment on Skype when I saw the little girls, you know. Both of them had like milk bottles in their hands and they were crawling around. One was in a pink jacket and the other was in a purple jacket. It's just imprinted in my memory.
So I didn't see how it could be a problem since Lakshmi Narayan, for the one criteria I had, was to love my daughters as much as I do. You know, it was a really hard decision, but I couldn't give them to anybody else who could not see what treasures they were and would love them and raise them similar to how I really wanted them to be raised but couldn't do myself.
Race was the last thing that came up, and we saw the children, we fell in love like immediately. So eventually when our daughters came home, to me, it felt very natural, but I don't know how it appeared to the rest of the world. I'm sure there was a novelty, there was fascination about the fact that the girls had, you know, blonde hair and they looked like dolls.
One neighbor tried to tell me that Lakshmi and Narayan were going to do arranged marriages for the girls, even though Lakshmi and I had a discussion about that. And she would like our girls to marry for love, which I do agree with, but I'm also not against the arranged marriage because I have really bad experience with normal social dating in America. But that is my own opinion, and apparently mine is completely different from my own family's, despite the fact that we were raised together. They have more conservative views when it comes to raising the girls and stuff. They say that they're okay with certain things, but then there's other things they're not okay with, like they're not okay with Lakshmi being vegetarian, and that's not their choice.
To kind of follow up on that, how is openness working out? Like, I know I'm in touch with you, I'm in touch with Gigi and Grandpa, but there's no direct contact between me and Corey and Alan. But how do they react to the fact that you're in touch and it's kind of in your face all the time, and you probably talk about it to them, right?
Oh, I talk to them about it all the time. Actually, my grandparents were more accepting of it than my own father or my brothers were. And I even share them the pictures that you send me. I think this openness is actually making it easier because I can show them every day. This is what's going on. This is what they're doing. This is how they're being raised. And yeah, Corey or Alan will make some kind of comment. Well, Alan will make a comment about the religion, and Corey will make a comment about how the girls don't eat meat. And Alan's comments about the Hindu religion are really ignorant and short-sighted because Christianity, yes, it is a good religion, but it's not better than any other religion. So I'm always constantly fighting with him on that.
Is there anything I can do to help? Like, if you can forward the questions, maybe I can try and, you know, explain my reasons for why we are raising the kids this way.
Actually, I have been telling Corey, especially when it comes to the eating meat, that you were against taking a life and cooking meat for the girls to eat, even if it's just for the girls, really offends you as a person and you don't feel right doing it, which is why I'm not going to try and force his views on you.
Mm-hmm.
He feels that you should be cooking the meat every day, and I tell him that's not logical, nor is that right, because that's forcing you to do something that is against your religion.
This is the first time I'm hearing in so much depth about it. But like, I mean, the core thing is that end of day, Anjali and Meghna are our children between me and Brandy. I definitely will feel a lot differently about it if Brandy felt this way. Knowing that it's Alan and Corey, yes, they have They're open to suggest things, but it carries lesser weight to me. I don't think my decision on how to raise the children will change significantly. I'm still open to them trying what they want to. And I've told them many times that once they turn 18, they're adults, they can, choose how to live their lives. I'm not going to, dictate what they can eat or what religion they're going to follow. It's completely up to them. But while they live with me and are part of our family, we will do it mine and Narayanan's way. And the rules are the same for all three of my children, not just Anjali and Meghna.
What I've always told Lakshmi and what I'm going to tell you now is that, Lakshmi, I'm grateful that you are Anjali's and Meghna's mom. You are doing a great job. And what I want them to know is that race should never matter. It's all about who you are as a person and how you treat others as people. And if anybody is going to get onto you about the race of your parents or your own race and they're not going to understand, then you don't need them in your life. Because your Emma loves you and she will always love you, no matter what. And I'm glad that I chose you and Narayan because you do love them as much as I do. And I hope that you can continue at least sending me pictures of how great you're doing with them.
Actually, I am completely on board with what you said, Brandy, and I am incredibly grateful to have you in my life, not just for the children. It's just that I do think people's lives cross each other for a reason, and I'm learning so much from you, and the fact that you can be this accepting of how we are raising the children, and I want you to have a say in, how we raise the children and be a part of their lives forever. And in that sense, I am so, so, so happy that we have the relationship that we have. As far as Anjali and Meghna go, I would just like to tell them one thing. You cut open the skin, the blood's the same. We are all the same inside. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
End of day, that's all that counts. We're all people. And if we can grow up to be good human beings, that's all that matters.
The story of Lakshmi and Brandy and their families. We've heard from so many of you across the country. Have a conversation about race you want to share with us? You can take part in our Uncomfortable Truth series. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or check out thetakeaway.org/truths. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick, and let's return now to our coverage of Hurricane Harvey in Texas, where extensive damage already means officials are preparing for the long haul.
FEMA's going to be there for years, sir. This disaster is going to be a landmark event, and we're already in the stages. While we're focused on response right now and helping Texas, respond, we're already pushing forward recovery housing teams. We're already pushing forward forces to be on the ground to implement national flood insurance program policies as well and doing the inspections that we need. So we're setting up and gearing up for the next couple years.
That's FEMA Administrator Brock Long speaking to CNN's Jake Tapper on Sunday. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service issued a warning on Twitter. It said, "This event is unprecedented and all impacts are unknown and beyond anything experienced. Follow orders from officials to ensure safety." And that was a stark warning, more dire for sure than what you'd usually hear from the National Weather Service. Dr. Louis Uccellini is leading that agency. He's director of the National Weather Service, and he joins me now via Skype. Dr. Uccellini, welcome.
Thank you.
You've been director of the National Weather Service since 2013. That was a very stark warning that I just read from Twitter from your agency. Is this the biggest storm that you've ever seen under your watch?
Oh, it's certainly the biggest tropical storm that has occurred under my watch. And it's a very dangerous and prolonged event. So, and we're seeing the unprecedented impacts already in the area around Houston. And we got a long way to go with this storm.
Can you talk from the meteorologist's perspective about what makes Harvey unique, what makes it more catastrophic, even compared to storms like Katrina, Sandy, other big storms that we've seen? From the way a meteorologist looks at it, what's so bad about it?
It developed rapidly once it emerged from the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. It hit a warm pool of water in the Gulf of Mexico and intensified very rapidly, very close to shore. So no time to lose some of that punch. So we had very strong winds and a very strong surge northeast of that storm. And it's very slow movement. And in fact, it stalled over Texas and is now moving back towards the coast, allowed a tremendous amount of moisture to come off the Gulf of Mexico, resulting in heavy rainfalls in a large area of south, central, and eastern Texas, which is still ongoing and moving into Louisiana even as we speak.
And we've seen those reports of, I mean, you say heavy rainfalls, in some cases 20 inches, 24 inches of rain falling on Houston and the surrounding area. What accounts for so much moisture, other than the fact, of course, that the storm is parked over Houston, but so much water being drawn up and then dropped back down?
Well, the Gulf of Mexico is one of the warmer ocean or a sea level type of moisture sources, and it's obviously very close to the Texas coast and inland areas. And with the circulation, like we saw around Harvey, just drawing from that source, the atmosphere immediately over this warm water body, just continually feeding these convective areas as they develop. So we were seeing rainfall rates approaching 4, 5, 6, and in some cases estimated at 8 inches per hour in these bands. So it's a slow-moving storm, and these bands are very slow to move away from an area. We're getting these extreme rainfall events in 12 hours.
That unbelievable rate, Dr. Uccellini, eight inches per hour in some cases, is that rate unprecedented as well?
We don't see that very often, and having it sustained within a system, of course, these bands move, so you get a series of these cells moving over your particular area, you can get up to 15, 20 inches of rain in 12 to 18 hours, which is what happened in Houston and the surrounding areas on Friday night into Saturday morning. And we had a serious flooding situation developing in eastern Texas and western Louisiana today for the same kind of a band. So, it's the nature of the airflow into these bands and the fact that we have a very slow-moving system, which makes it unprecedented.
Yeah. What was forecasting and modeling this storm like from the perspective of your agency? Of course, there was plenty of lead time, bad storm, moving west, going to hit Texas. In terms of the magnitude and the potential damage, what was the challenge in the forecast for your people?
As we came out of last weekend, we started seeing the models converging towards a track of the storm towards Texas. And our higher resolution models, which has the physical processes that can drive these storms built into it, started showing rapid development right along the coast. We, we treat those cautiously. We really do not want to have the false alarm go out, so we're very careful in stepping this forecast up. But when we started seeing the rainfall rates and the amount of rain, the total amount of rain being predicted for the total event over a 5, 6, or 7 day period, approaching 50 inches, we were skeptical at first, but the models kept on coming back. We started seeing the parameters, that were feeding into these rainfall rates. In other words, we were seeing that the models were predicting the rainfall rates based on physical processes, not on numerical factors within the models. So we started increasing the alarm and with increasing confidence that this storm had the potential of dumping feet of rain over a large area, and that would just compound the impacts in a very serious way.
And we've seen that, and it makes me really want to ask, given the strength of other storms that we've seen, including Sandy, including Harvey now, based on the data that you have and the numbers that your personnel and your scientists watch as they develop over the course of these storms, are storms of this strength more likely in the future?
We try to avoid the comparisons. We can do that after the event. There's some similarities. There's some big differences between Harvey and a storm like Katrina that hit and kept on moving and not lingering. Part of this is, Category 4 storm, even for the Texas coast. Hitting the coast as a Category 4 is not a common event. The last one that happened was in 1961. And so these are spaced out in time. What's really unusual about this storm is maintaining its circulation, even as it made an inland track, and then stopping and reversing it towards the coast, even as we speak, where it can regenerate, slightly But the main point is it's maintaining the circulation for heavy rain. So that has unique characteristics that are not similar to Katrina or Sandy. They caused their havoc for slightly different reasons. And so we're very careful about trying to make comparisons between one storm and the other. This is a unique and I want to say prolonged and very dangerous storm system.
Dr. Louis Uccellini is director of the National Weather Service. Thank you, doctor.
All right, thank you.
Well, that's going to do it for us today. We've been hearing from some of you about how Hurricane Harvey has impacted your family and friends.
This is Liza Hagerman, currently living in Lafayette, Indiana. My parents live in Portland, Texas, in between Corpus Christi and Rockport. We're slowly learning about the damage from people down there. It's heartening to hear about all the cleanup being done, but we still don't know much about the state of their apartment or workplace. We do know it will be another week or two before they can return home due to utilities damages.
This is Annette Rodriguez in Austin, Texas. Whole trees and large limbs are falling down in our general area of Austin due to the strong winds and heavy rain here. Our nephew just pulled a tree off of his house, hooking it up to his Jeep to pull it off, and then we'll assess the damage to the house. We actually just now had a tree fall and block our driveway, too.
Your voices in the aftermath of the storm. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.